Hello and welcome to We Watch Movies, a podcast where we watch movies and then talk about them. I am Elijah, and with me is my good buddy Forrest. How are you doing today, Forrest?
I'm doing pretty darn good.
Pretty darn well. You're doing pretty well. It's a grammar lesson there for you.
No, pretty darn good.
You're not.
We don't have grammar where I come from.
Superman does good.
So how you been, man?
Not bad. Life's pretty crazy, but we're getting stuff done and we're making a podcast, so that's fun. How have you been?
Well, 2020 has been crazy, so this has been the highlight of my year, so yeah. I'm pretty excited for this.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff happening.
Yeah, but it's good to get away from it every now and then.
Yeah, we're going to try to be an escape from that. Like I said in the intro, we are going to talk about a couple movies this week. We have David McKenzie's 2016 neo-western Hell or High Water and Sergio Corbucci's 1968 spaghetti western The Great Silence. A bit of a western theme this week, which is, it's okay, I suppose.
I suppose. Wow.
I mean, I love one of these movies.
And the other is possibly the worst film we've watched and discussed on this podcast to date.
Yeah, I can get totally down with that opinion.
Yep. Yeah.
But before we get started, I do just want to cover a few things. First, there will be a spoiler alert, not only for those two movies, but for a lot of movies in 2016, because our second segment is If Best Scene Were an Oscar 2016. So you have been warned. From here on out, we are in the spoiler zone. That is that. Also, we have an Instagram account. So follow us on Instagram at WeWatchMoviesPodcast. Forrest updates that a couple times every week with the movies we're watching and does little previews, I think.
That is correct.
Sweet.
Yeah.
Is there anything you want to say before we dive right in?
Well, I'll just do a little Western for Dummies class here. So gather around, everyone. Find your seats. Find your seats.
We probably should have done this last week.
I'm going to explain the difference between a Western.
I'm a dummy.
Because? Okay. So I'm going to explain the difference between a neo-Western and a spaghetti Western. So a neo-Western is a modern Western set in modern times. Get it? Neo-Western. Very simple. A spaghetti Western is a Western that was made typically in the 60s, was its heyday, but 70s, 50s, there were some spaghetti because they were usually filmed in either Italy or Spain and usually were directed by, you guessed it, Italian directors. Directors of note would be Sergio Corbucci, which we're talking about, The Great Silence, and the magnificent Sergio Leone. So lots of Sergios out there.
He did the super famous one, right? The good, bad, and ugly.
Yeah, he did the whole Dollars trilogy, which was capped off with The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
You can tell I've watched many Westerns in my day. So
we'll get to The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
I've got a Western question for you here.
All right.
You've given us neo-Western. You've given us spaghetti Western. Now, is just like a Western, like an American John Wayne type Western from the oldie times?
That would be a Hollywood Western.
Okay, so is there any Western that's just called Western?
I mean, they're all Westerns and they fit into different subgenres. If I pointed to one and said that's just a Western, that's hard to do. I would say, okay, Unforgiven is a Western.
Okay. Thank you for that point of reference.
There we go.
Also, I think we said Western like 150 times in the past 10 seconds.
Western.
It stopped sounding like a word at this point.
Is he saying Western? What is he saying? This is absolutely really ridiculous.
All right. So is that voice. I say we just jump right in and save the best for last. So You ready?
Agreed. I'm ready.
Okay, let's start us off. Why don't you intro The Great Silence for us?
All right. The Great Silence by Sergio Corbucci. After the death of her spouse at the hands of an unruly bounty hunter, a grieving widow hires a silent but deadly mercenary to kill her husband's murderer.
Yes.
That is the summary. Like I said, directed by Sergio Corbucci. There are two primary actors. I don't want to butcher their names, so I'm not going to say their names, but the two primary characters in the film are Loco, which is the insane bounty hunter, aptly named, by the way, and
Green Scarf Guy.
Green Scarf Guy. And Silent, also aptly named, who is the protagonist mercenary. So, Elijah, you're not a Western fan.
No.
So, going into any Western, you're a little, your bar is incredibly low. Is that safe to say?
It is. I think I've liked three Westerns, and one of them you might not even be able to call a Western.
The Revenant?
Yeah.
So I understood that it would be hard to impress you in this genre. But I am a huge Western fan. I love Westerns, John Wayne, Clint Eastwood, the modern Westerns. I'm just a big fan. I'm a big fan. Sergio Leone is great. All right. In preparation for this week, I was trying to decide which Western was I going to pick. Was I going to pick one I had already seen, like Tombstone or The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly or Unforgiven, or was I going to go with something new? And I decided to go with something I hadn't seen to keep things interesting. And so I picked The Great Silence.
You regret that decision?
I'm just trying to justify why I picked it. I picked The Great Silence because I've been watching Cinefix, and they talked ad nauseum about this film. The Great Silence, The Great Silence, The Great Silence. It's so dark. It's so good. I looked on Rotten Tomatoes. It had a 100% on Rotten Tomatoes. I was like, man, I got to watch this movie. So I said, hey, let's watch The Great Silence. It should be some pretty good film. Elijah, I don't think this met your incredibly low bar.
I'm gonna say this. I absolutely loved the first 90 seconds of this movie.
I agree.
I unironically, the first 90 seconds of this movie were immaculately directed, had a ton of symbolism, especially with color, and had some really pretty shots.
Yeah.
So now my negatives with the movie. Everything else.
Yeah. What did you think about the snow setting? It's a bit away from the typical Western.
I'll say, I did like that. I didn't know Westerns could have snow.
Really?
And snow is cooler than sand, in my opinion. That's just personal thing I have. Sand is rough and coarse and irritating. It gets everywhere, you know?
Okay, Anakin.
I was hoping you would just take that in stride, like it was totally natural thing for me to say.
Oh, no. No. Don't be ridiculous.
But yeah, I think snow is a cool setting.
Yeah.
So I was like, wow, this one has snow. That's good.
So this is interesting. The snow that they used in the town of Snow Hill was created by gallons upon gallons of shaving cream.
I feel sorry for the people who were buried in it.
It is also, by the way, Quentin Tarantino's favorite snow western.
Yeah, I love a lot of his movies. He's got some odd taste in movies.
He's a weirdo. I'm going to say it right now. I don't like Quentin Tarantino. I think he's weird. I know you like him. I respect that.
He is certainly an acquired taste.
But before we get into strictly The Great Silence, do you want to talk about a little bit about how this film inspired Quentin Tarantino's The Hateful Eight?
Well, I didn't know that it did, but I can improv draw some connections right now, because both are Westerns that take place in the snow and both have violence.
How about blood. The carriage ride sequence?
Yep, that's a thing. The stagecoach thing.
The stagecoach with the protagonist and the antagonist, or the supposed antagonist, sitting in there riding together the bounty hunter's bodies.
Yeah, just the Hateful Eight was a little different because you didn't really know who was the good guy and bad guy at that point, so there wasn't really much tension for there. Sure. The Hateful Eight was really kind of weak. Not Tarantino's best. You want good Tarantino, you watch Pulp Fiction, Inglourious Bastards, or Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Any of those three, you're all set.
Or you can do as I do and just don't watch any. Just don't watch any.
Yeah. Watch Speed Racer instead. That's a great way to spend your Friday night.
You know what? I'm actually behind you on that. Watch Speed Racer instead of any of Quentin Tarantino's films.
I'm going to take that. I'm just going to take that. I like how we've been talking about The Great Silence for like 10 minutes and 5 of those minutes haven't been about The Great Silence.
One more point about The Hateful Eight and Great Silence is they had the same composer.
I did know that.
Ennio Morricone.
He's very good.
He is legendary.
His score for Hateful Eight was very good, and his score was decent for this one too, The Great Silence.
It was okay. You want great Ennio Morricone, you go watch The Good, The Bad, and The Ugly.
I'm sure I'll get there when I have 3 hours to spare.
The Good, The Bad, and The Ugly theme song and Ecstasy of Gold. Those two songs, you know. Even if you don't know, you know them.
Okay, I'm sure I've heard them. I'm sure I have. One thing I will say about his scores, I can't say this is like a universal thing because I've seen two of the movies he's scored, but I've noticed a lot of his score plays during interlude rather than over or under the action. In The Hateful Eight, 90% of his score happens during these long sections of transitional shots with exterior establishing location shots and horses and stuff. And I noticed that kind of in The Great Silence too. During the action and dialogue, there isn't much score, but during the transitional scenes, the score really kind of picks up in bombast. And it's cool. I think it's interesting technique. It feels more like it makes it feel more like a stage production, in my opinion. That's kind of a weird thing. I don't know why it makes me feel that way, but it does.
Yeah. You know, one final note about Morricone before we get strictly back into talking about The Great Silence is when Morricone composed for The Good, The Bad, and The Ugly, Sergio Leone, not Corbucci, Sergio Leone had him compose his music and then framed shots to go along with the music.
That's cool. That reminds me of how Joker was scored.
Oh
yeah. I can't remember the composer's name, but she won the Oscar for best score for Joker.
Oh nice.
Phenomenal score, but she was given the script and she wrote her score based on the script, not based on the shots.
Okay. I think it works.
It does. You should watch Joker at some point.
I think we're going to get to that because that is one I've been wanting to see for a while now.
It's quite the movie. Lots to talk about with that one.
Yeah. So going back to The Great Silence, like you said, the first 90 seconds, great. I was engaged. It was interesting.
Great short film right there.
And then they had to open their mouths.
Yeah. We do have to say.
You do. Yeah. Clarify.
The only version that was available to me was the American, or not the English dub of the Italian dialogue.
Yep.
And first off, the ADR was just bad.
It was like, horrible.
Really bad. The voices took a while to get used to. I did eventually, but I would have preferred to watch it subbed. I feel like I would have gotten more out of it, but I could not find a subbed version. So that did harm our enjoyment of it. Not that there was much to be had anyway.
I was looking at it on iTunes. They have both the original language, the Italian, and the English dubs. And I was trying to weigh which one I was going to watch. And I ultimately decided on the English dubs, and I realized that was a huge mistake, especially when there was a scene pretty early in the film where there was a bounty hunter eating chicken.
Oh, I took my headphones off for that.
And they dubbed the sound of him eating the chicken.
It was disgusting. Stop. Don't do that.
If we did a list of the worst sounds in movies, it would be number one on my list.
Yeah, I can't think of one that's worse.
And then he blows his nose.
And then he gets killed. By the way, so many people died in this movie, and half of them I didn't know why.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think he was one of the... No, he was killed by Silence, so he was a bad guy. He was part of the bad guys.
He was a bad guy.
Yeah.
Also, it was a little rough at first because Loco and Silence looked very similar.
Yeah, they did. A lot of them looked very similar.
I was like, why is Silence speaking now? Why did he shoot that guy? I thought this was the good guy.
Oh, man. Okay, I will say, I'm going to pick out a few things that I liked before we really continue. I did like the idea that he only attacks in self-defense. So that scene...
It was clever.
Yeah, that was neat. That scene in where Loco's playing cards or whatever, and he's like, I know your thing. I just won't hit you or won't... Whatever. That was a good scene. I liked that scene. Yeah. And then Silence just... Oh, what happens? Loco hits him or something, and then Silas just grabs something and bashes his head and throws him outside or something.
Exactly.
That was a pretty cool scene.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no. I thought Loco was the best character in the film, and I thought the actor played that role very well, even behind the English dubs.
Yeah. It was good. Green scarf guy.
Yeah. Green scarf guy. Can we agree that one of the worst parts of this film was the editing?
Yeah.
It was so pedestrian. It was so shoddy. Everything was just, it felt so in shambles.
It had 80s action syndrome before 80s action.
It was really a shock to me. And I'm going to draw this comparison again. Sergio Corbucci is he is so inferior to Sergio Leone behind the camera. It's ridiculous.
Have you seen any other Corbucci movies?
I do want to see Django. I haven't seen any of the others.
Ooh, Django Unchained by Quentin Tarantino. That's a really good movie. Is that a Western? I like that one. Maybe I like Westerns, or at least new ones.
It's a Western.
Cool. That's four.
Yeah.
It's great. Leo is great in it. Jamie Foxx is great in it. Christoph Waltz is really good.
See, this is how we cope with bad movies. We just talk about other movies. They happen to be movies I don't like, but...
Have you seen Django Unchained?
I have not seen Django Unchained. It's Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah. It's great.
Go watch Speed Racer instead.
You don't have to ask me twice.
I know. So it was interesting that Silence had this reputation going around how he was deadly and he was incredibly accurate with his weapon. But he was kind of cheating. He had that Mauser, which is just, I think it's semi-automatic.
Yep,
it is. Having that Mauser just makes up so much for any inaccuracy. So by the time, you know, with the Loco with his standard revolver, any of the other characters can, you know, fire and cock the revolver back again, he's just fired off four shots. So I thought that was...
Yeah, I agree. Also, I'd like to point out that a lot of people in this movie are very adept at shooting thumbs off from the hip.
Yeah.
Like, they weren't even using sights or anything. These people are just blasting thumbs off left and right from the hip.
I'll just eyeball that thing.
No yeah. problem. I think one time somebody gets two thumbs in one go.
I know, it's amazing. I'm not quite sure why the thumbs, but sure, we can, let's do it. You know, it was also down in Western history. Thumbs come off.
Yeah, I want to go down in Western history. What can I do to make a unique mark on the genre? I know, shoot off a lot of thumbs.
When they shoot their thumbs off, brilliant.
Also, I never think of that. All of the blood in this movie looked like paint.
Probably was.
It was embarrassingly bad fake blood.
Yes.
Okay. Do you mind if I bring up my least favorite thing about the movie?
Go ahead.
I'm not going into a lot of detail with this at all, but the female lead of this movie, her husband was shot and murdered in front of her. Like,
yes.
How many days do you think pass before Silence shows up?
I think like 3 days, maybe. Okay, it hadn't been a long time.
Yeah, we'll give it 3 days. 3 days, Silence goes into town. She hires him to kill the guy who killed her husband. Cool. Literally like the next night they're sleeping together. How messed up is that? That is so messed up. Her husband died like 3 days ago. That's a problem.
I guess grieving was not the proper way to...
I guess not.
It was not the proper adjective to widow.
She moved right on to acceptance real quick.
The accepting widow.
Okay. That's all I want to talk about that. It was disgusting and the worst part of the movie by far, and that's saying something.
I skipped it. It went on way too long.
It was terrible. We don't need to talk about it anymore.
Why is this in here? How did it contribute to anything in the film? Oh, that's right. It didn't.
0%. It made it worse.
You know what's amazing is it's about an hour and 45 minutes, hour and 46 minutes. But this felt like an incredibly long film because for the majority of it, nothing happened.
It felt like 2.5 hours. It was so bad. The editing is bad. The pacing is terrible.
Yeah.
The action is poorly shot. That terrible romance is stupid.
Yeah.
The dub was awful. I liked the first 90 seconds.
You know, it was interesting. That Sergio Corbucci had gotten the idea of a silent protagonist because he was talking with this guy who wanted to do a Western but didn't speak English. So he had it in the back of his mind. And then when he met the actor that played Silence, you found out that this guy didn't speak English. So he was like, brilliant, which I don't know. It doesn't make any sense to me because the whole thing's in Italian.
Yeah.
So I don't follow that logic at all, but also, that's what I found in my research.
You don't have to be Italian to not talk. Like, yeah. Anybody can not talk when they're acting.
Yeah. I know. Interesting note. This was actually remade as a Japanese samurai TV series in 1973.
Which that sounds cool.
Sounds more interesting.
I would watch that. That sounds really... I like samurais more than cowboys anyway, but that sounds cool.
It sounds interesting. It sounds really interesting.
Is the plural of samurai, samurai, or samurais?
Well, it's seven samurai.
So, okay. Yeah, I guess it is. That would be, I like samurai more than cowboys. There's another grammar. That's two grammar lessons today.
Yeah, it's true. So because of the dark ending of this film.
Oh, yeah.
20th century. Yeah, it was a dark ending.
Yeah, but they both died.
Because of that, 20th Century Fox refused to release it in the United States, and it didn't become available here in America until 2001.
Not a huge loss, I'm not going to lie.
Talk about that ending real quick.
Yeah.
Because we want to move on to better and brighter things.
Yeah.
I'll say this. I was watching it, and I thought to myself, the only justifiable ending to this film is if he just shoots Silence dead. Let's just go, you know, it's so bad already. Let's just go against stereotype and let the silent stranger die. And guess what?
Yeah.
He died.
He died. So did Gruesome. The nice lady, or the creepy lady.
Nice lady. Yeah, she was a creepy lady. And then all of the hostages died. It's like, okay. Oh. Okay. All right.
This is what I'm going to say about this. You learn at the end of this movie that it's propaganda. It's literally anti-bounty hunter propaganda.
Yep.
And I'm just going to say that from a storytelling perspective, that sucks. Because
yep.
You've watched movies before and you follow a protagonist and you're like, awesome, I'm going to follow this person's journey, their arc, their growth, and we're going to reach a conclusion at the end that is satisfying and have a victory. Except he just dies and there's no point to his death. Like Officer K in Blade Runner 2049, there's a point to his death. Han Solo in The Force Awakens, there's a point to his death. Silence in The Great Silence, he just dies.
Well, I do want to contend one point. And to be fair, it was explained in the final, whatever it was, the words on the screen at the end there. But they were trying to tie together the death of Silence as to some reform in terms of how about the bounty system worked.
Right. But that makes it less of a movie about characters who I care about and want mm-hmm. to root for, and more of a movie about like a legal squabble.
Should I bring up the real world allegory that Corbucci had, or should I just let people Google that on their own if they're interested?
Go for it. I haven't heard it.
Well, so actually Corbucci wrote this as anti-authoritarianism propaganda, comparing Silence's death to the death of Che Guevara.
I don't know who that is.
Fair enough. He was a communist in South America. So.
Oh, well.
Yep.
Wait, so Silence was representing... So the guy who we were rooting for was representing communism?
Yeah. In retrospect, I found out that Corbucci was a pretty big communist.
Wow, this movie is a freaking ride from start to finish. Oh man. Okay, so not only is this film anti bounty hunter propaganda, it's low key communism propaganda.
It is the antithesis of Sergio Leone's Fistful of Dollars, where the stranger rolls into a corrupt town and cleans it up. In this movie, he rolls into the corrupt town and
just dies. He just dies. And then the woman like runs out from her hiding spot and tries to grab the gun. And he's just like, okay, and shoots her too.
Yeah, because
really, so dumb.
I mean, at this point, I don't even blame Loco.
Yeah, I like, cool, dude. You're making money. Like, good for you, man.
I don't even blame him. Come on.
Okay, can we move on? Can we score this thing?
Yeah, let's just. I just want to point out how bad the sheriff was. Just,
oh, he sucked. Horrendously bad. I forgot about him.
He was half. I couldn't tell if they were trying to make him a clown or the serious character, because he's talking serious to the outlaws, and then he's punching the prison bars like an idiot. Ow! You didn't think that was going to happen, genius?
After the bandits take his horse, the shot of him awkwardly waddling off into the wilderness was hilarious.
He was horrible. I'm ready to move on.
Okay.
What do you give it?
I'm going to give it a 2 out of 10. I enjoyed the first 90 seconds, and I think there's a lot of merit in those 90 seconds and even flashes of directorial brilliance. And all of that vanishes in a swath of propaganda and stupid character decisions and creepy character decisions and poor editing surrounded by a pretty decent musical score. That's just about the only other thing that redeems it.
When people say about Sergio Corbucci that he's the best spaghetti Western director not named Sergio Leone, it's that's kind of an insult. I'm going to, however, give this a 3 out of 10.
Generous. Because
I'm being generous today. I guess I have a little more appreciation for maybe its context in the genre, but it was still bad. Actually, I'm going to go 2 out of 10 because it was bad as I'm thinking about it.
There were three things I liked: the score, the first 90 seconds, and there was snow in it.
Yeah. Yeah. Morricone is always a win, but those first 90 seconds were great until someone opened their mouths, and snow is always fun. I love snow. Yeah. It's a stark contrast to the dry, pale desert of Italy or Spain.
Yeah. Classic. All right. Deserts in Italy and Spain.
That's where all the cowboys were.
Yeah, man. I've heard Indians have visited there too. That was probably super insensitive, and I apologize if it was. Anyway, you ready to move on to more fun times?
Yes, let's move on to fun times at Midland Bank.
Midland Bank. I think like 4 Midland banks, or maybe 3 Midland banks and 1 other bank. Anyway, this is Hell or High Water, directed by David McKenzie, written by Taylor Sheridan.
Who's awesome.
Who is of note for writing a lot of great. He's one of the few Hollywood writers who's famous for writing.
Yeah. He was also in Sons of Anarchy.
Oh, cool. So he wrote it. It stars Chris Pine, Ben Foster, and Jeff Bridges.
Yes. And Gil Birmingham. Don't forget about Gil.
Yes.
He was great in this film.
How could I forget about Gil? You want to hit us with your summary?
Yeah. Two brothers begin a bank robbing spree across the Lone Star State in order to earn enough money to pay off the debt on their family ranch. To put an end to their string of crimes, two Texas Rangers are tasked with finding and stopping the culprits.
And that's about it. It's a very simple storyline, but dang, is it pulled off really well.
Well, you will notice as you watch more Westerns that a lot of the plots are fairly simplistic, and good Westerns along the way either provide you with great action or a great human tale and very personal stories.
Both of those.
I agree.
Hell or High Water is an excellent movie. I like it a lot.
Yeah. It is great. I don't know what took me so long to watch this movie.
It seems right up your alley.
Yeah, it is. So it is the second in a trilogy of films written by Taylor Sheridan. I'm not sure if they were all made by the same studios, but Sheridan wrote them all. It is I believe it's the look at the modern American frontier trilogy, something like that.
It's an unofficial trilogy.
Yeah. It starts with Sicario in 2015, continues with Hell or High Water in 2016, and ends with Wind River in 2017.
I believe he also directed Wind River.
I would have to double check you on that.
I think he did. Well,
but that said, all of them are very, very fresh on Rotten Tomatoes. I have seen Sicario and obviously this. I've yet to see Wind River. Very much look forward to it. Wind River was directed by Taylor Sheridan. So good of you.
Nailed it. Sicario is one of my straight up favorite movies ever. I love Sicario. So yeah. Taylor Sheridan, he's a good one.
Yeah. He's also done work on Kevin Costner's Yellowstone series. He's acted and written and directed in it, I think.
Jack of all trades. So what, I had seen this movie before, so I'm curious your first impressions. What did you think of that opening tracking shot following the car around the bank and seeing that woman going in and everything that happens from there?
Well, it was interesting. It was interesting the perception I got of who was going to be in that specific vehicle. I thought they were going to be some younger guys, maybe out, you know, just to make a couple extra dollars. I wasn't quite sure what they were up to. And then you see Chris Pine and Ben Foster hop out of the car. And I was like, holy crap. And they run into the bank. And, oh, that opening bank scene is pure gold. It is hilarious.
Yeah.
It shows the two, and it also shows the two brothers, their characteristics so well.
Yeah.
Chris Pine's character, he's clearly new at this, and yep. You can tell almost instantly he is not a criminal. And yeah. with his brother, without any backstory it's revealed later that he is a criminal that had been in prison. You can tell right away this guy is no good.
Yeah. It's so impressive how just... It's such a perfect example of show don't tell, just through the way the characters are written and the way they're portrayed by Chris Pine and Ben Foster. You can immediately tell that Chris Pine is cautious. He's nervous. He wants to only stick to the plan. He doesn't want to hurt anybody. And Ben Foster's jumping over countertops and being rough with the teller and all that, and just talking crap to her. It is such brilliant execution from all sides of the filmmaking process.
Agreed. And here's a kind of fun note. Chris Pine plays the younger brother. However, he's 2 months older than Ben Foster in real life, which I thought was kind of funny.
That is funny.
Ben Foster definitely puts on the air of having much more years of experience, certainly in the crime world, than the naive Chris Pine.
You know, in a movie with Chris Pine and Jeff Bridges, Ben Foster kind of steals the show.
Dude, I freaking love Ben Foster. One of the other Westerns I'm going to have you watch at some point is 310 to Yuma, James Mangold's remake. And Ben Foster steals the show in that film that stars Kurt Russell. Russell Crowe and Christian Bale.
Wow, dang. Yeah. Ben Foster is brilliant. And not to say, like, Chris Pine and Jeff Bridges are also brilliant. But Ben Foster, he is magnetic on screen. I love the dynamic between these two brothers. And you can tell they're brothers because they have that relationship that's just like, screw you, you're the worst, I hate you. But also they are just unbreakable. They have that unbreakable bond.
Also, here, have a beer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And get drunk off of beer.
I loved that scene. Don't drink. I need you alert tomorrow. Who gets drunk off beer? And I was like, wait, can you get drunk off beer?
Yes. I don't know. Yes, you can.
Not Ben Foster, though.
Not Ben Foster.
I love the scene where Chris Pine is visiting his ex-wife and his two boys, and he's talking to his eldest boy and offers him a beer.
Yeah. And he's like, he had just gotten finished telling him, like, don't do what I do. And the kid's like, do you want me to drink it or not? If I do, I'm doing what you do.
You tell me not to be like you, and yet you offer me a beer. Yeah.
That was good boy.
You know what's funny, though, is Texas is one of 10 states that allows minor consumption of alcohol in private residences.
Oh. You know way too much about the South.
Well, I am from the South.
You're not wrong.
Also, while the film takes place in West Texas, all of the principal photography was in New Mexico.
Cool.
So go figure.
Yeah. So moving on, we have this one half of the movie that is about the relationship between the two brothers. And then on the other half, the other side of the movie, we have the two cops, the Rangers, Texas Rangers, trying to catch the brothers. And they are, they have their own relationship, which is fascinating and interesting to watch. And it really consists, I'm sorry, what is the Native American actor's name?
Gil Birmingham.
Gil Birmingham. We have Jeff Bridges playing classic Southern white old guy. Yeah, Jeff Bridges. And Gil Birmingham playing a Native American Texas Ranger.
Oh, it's interesting. Yeah.
And they just play off of each other. Basically, their whole relationship is Jeff Bridges making racist jokes to this guy and him just like grimacing.
It was kind of interesting because they have this banter back and forth, and obviously Jeff Bridges is insulting him, and you can't tell if he's offended or if he enjoys it, and it kind of seemed like a little bit of both. And yeah, definitely towards the end it seemed like this was more a friendly jabbing thing, and maybe Gil Birmingham's character enjoyed it more than he would like to let on. But in the same respect, maybe didn't appreciate it so much.
I mean, yeah, it was really, really pretty racist stuff. But
yeah,
I think you can tell that Jeff Bridges' character, he wants the banter. That's what he wants. Like the few times that Gil's character punches back, like Jeff Bridges is like, heck yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah, it certainly seems that regardless of what he says, it seems if this doesn't sound odd, his best intentions, if you will.
Yeah. Yeah. And
it was kind of interesting. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to bring up toward the ending, but you go ahead.
No, it was kind of interesting. Jeff Bridges modeled his character around an actual Texas Ranger, and Taylor Sheridan wrote the role of, wrote Jeff Bridges' role and modeled it after, I believe, one of his own family members.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Who was a Texas Ranger. Wow. Yeah. His uncle, he was a federal marshal who was forced into retirement himself.
That's interesting. It's clear that a lot of thought went into all of the characters, honestly. Mm-hmm. But throughout the movie, we see the brothers rob multiple Midlands banks because they're the bank who screwed them over with their ranch's mortgage. And they're doing this because Chris Pine's character, he wants to pay off that debt. And since they discovered oil on the ranch, he wants to pass the ranch down to his sons so they don't have to worry about money.
Right.
And we'll get into more about the themes of the movie later with the ending, because it's one of my favorite things about it. But we see them robbing these banks and the Rangers trying to catch them and all that. And eventually we get to the last heist, which is it's a much bigger Midlands bank. It's a lot busier with multiple tellers. And why don't you tell everybody, crap hits the fan real fast.
Yeah, crap does hit the fan real fast. And this also furthers the contrast between Ben Foster and Chris Pine's characters. Ben Foster's character is like, hey, let's go to this bank. One hit, it won't be a problem. And Chris Pine, clearly the more cautious of the two, was very apprehensive about it.
Yeah, he wanted to go to a smaller bank.
Smaller bank, and if they needed to, hit up the other bank.
Yeah.
Ben Foster's character throughout the film was very off the cuff. Nothing was planned. And despite his naivete, Chris Pine definitely was more reserved and let's think this through, even though he had no experience in criminal enterprises. I thought that was interesting. So they go to this larger bank and they walk in. I'm assuming it was on a Friday because they mentioned everyone, all the cowpokes going there for their paydays. Yeah. And literally the whole bank is full.
Yeah.
And you can see their eyes bug out, at least Chris Pine's. I can't remember. I think both of them both taken aback by it.
But naturally, Ben Foster just jumps into action, yelling at everyone to get down, jumps behind the counter with the tellers.
It's ridiculous.
There's one problem, though, is that they didn't just go into a full bank. They went into a full bank in Texas.
Oh, I love it. I love Texas. That was awesome.
So 5 minutes later, after they've gotten the cash and are running away, they're being chased by probably 10 or so armed Texans.
In pickup trucks.
Driving down the highway, Chris Pine gets shot. Oh, and he seals the wound with freaking duct tape.
Oh, and no wadding. No gauze.
No, just straight duct tape on the wound.
Oh, you got to do something there, man. Oh.
He did. He put duct tape on it.
No, it was. I love that scene you're about to come out.
Sorry, what?
I said, I love that scene you're about to talk about. Oh, yeah. They're driving down the highway being chased by those Texans.
It's one of those brotherly moments where Ben Foster seems to just kind of have an internal moment of acceptance. And he pulls over, gets out a freaking submachine gun, and just lights.
I think it's an AR-15 with a bump stock. My brother would know. He'll probably correct me later.
You would know better than I.
I will have to say, I am certain one of those Texans would have had an AR-15 stashed. Come on.
So unrealistic. Gosh.
Gosh. They just had hunting rifles and pistols? No.
But Ben Foster, in one of the just coolest looking shots, just slowly walks forward in his sunglasses with this just grimace on his face and just lights him up. And all of the trucks turn around and run away.
I love the double-ended clip. That was awesome.
That was so cool. That was awesome.
He just kicks it out, flips it over, kicks it back in, just keeps going. Oh.
It was awesome. And then Chris Pine gets into the other car that's been waiting, and Ben Foster leads the cops on a merry chase and has one of the cleverest kind of, I don't know, escape moves I've seen with the exploding truck.
That was clever, yeah.
Yeah.
And it speaks to, I mentioned earlier that Ben Foster seemed like the less prepared of the brothers, but it seems clear to me that he had intended this all along.
Yeah, you kind of do get that feeling.
Because he drove it specifically up there. He had the sniper rifle in the back.
Yep, and he had the gas can ready. He was prepared to do that from the beginning, and it just shows the immense love he has for his brother.
Right, because I think even in his mind, he could tell that he wasn't a good dude.
Yeah.
And he says earlier in the film, he was talking with this man in the casino, and this man was a member of the Comanche tribe. Mm-hmm. And the guy, and they kind of butt heads, and he says, "Do you know what Comanche means?" And Ben Foster says, "No." He says, I believe he says it means an enemy of everyone or something along those lines. Yeah. And he says to Ben Foster, "Do you know what that makes you?" And Ben Foster says, "I guess that makes me a Comanche."
Yeah. It's
but
and it's true, because the only person who isn't his enemy is his brother.
Exactly. And I think he knew that there was probably no getting off that mountain once he climbed up there in the rocks with the sniper rifle. And he was willing to sacrifice himself for his brother, so his brother and his family could have a life. But in the same respect, I think this is the point in the film where Ben Foster transitions from this gray character to this is the bad guy, because that's when for the first time the brothers and the Texas Rangers
face off,
collide.
Yeah, and Ben Foster lands an impressive shot right through Gil Bernstein's sunglasses and kills him. And I love that moment, because Jeff Bridges' character, in that moment, you can tell that the teasing and the making fun of and all the racist jokes, he loved that guy. And his reaction is heartbreaking when he sees him get shot.
Oh, yeah. I just want to say it again. Gil Birmingham was great in this film.
Oh, Birmingham. I said it
certainly
wrong.
Certainly over... it's certainly overshadowed by three huge actors, but he held his own so well, I thought.
Yeah, he did. And with him dead, Jeff Bridges is just like, okay, this guy is going down.
Mm-hmm.
And he...
And I think at that point, we as the audience are right there with him.
Yeah, we're like, okay. Because I feel like at this point, you understand Ben Foster, but you've disconnected from him and more latched on to Chris Pine.
Exactly.
And
you, because what you can't, as the viewer, justify his actions regardless of the means for what reason he's doing it. He killed the two people in the bank, and now he's sniping the Rangers from the mountains up there.
Yeah, and he's doing it for his brother, which is noble to some extent, but it goes too far, and he does need to be stopped, and Jeff Bridges has a beautiful shot, and you just see him go limp. And that's the end of Ben Foster.
Jeff Bridges' reaction, the first laugh, like, I did it, and then I think he just breaks down into sobbing.
Yeah, it's a beautiful moment of catharsis. It's just kind of heartbreaking, that whole sequence, but it's very well done, very affecting.
Mm-hmm.
And that leads us to the end sequence where we find out that Jeff Bridges retired, that nobody ever really found, the cops never found the second robber. They never found Chris Pine because he didn't have any connections to anything. And Jeff Bridges knows, he just knows that it was Chris Pine who was the other one. And my favorite scene in the movie actually is him at the end talking to Chris Pine at Chris Pine's ranch about why he did it.
I thought that was a very classic Western ending. I liked it.
Yeah, it was. I love it. I just love, you get the motivation finally with Chris Pine's, have you ever been poor speech?
Right.
And he's like, not my sons. That's where it ends. And I think that was, you get everything you need to know about his motivation in those 30 seconds.
For me, Chris Pine never felt like the bad guy. And it's interesting because throughout this film, I was always rooting for the Texas Rangers and the two brothers the same time.
Get them, but get away.
like when they were when the Rangers were investigating the one bank robbery and they're in the diner and the sassy waitress wouldn't give him the tip money and he sent Gil to go get it. I was like, yeah, go get that tip money. We got to find these guys. and then at the end, Chris Pine's driving to the casino to cash in the money. I'm like, get there. Come on. You gotta go.
Yeah. It's rare for a movie to do that. Both sides are your protagonists.
Yeah, and I loved that scene where Jeff Bridges definitely wasn't okay with what Chris Pine did, and he knew he let Chris Pine know that he knew he was involved, but there was almost this mutual respect that they could leave on.
Yeah, it was. I love that scene. I love that they agree to kind of finish the conversation later.
Yeah. Maybe over a beer or two.
Just don't get drunk on it.
Can't get drunk on beer.
But yeah, that's Hell or High Water. It is an excellent, excellent movie. I think both of us would highly recommend. Yeah.
Yeah. If you may, I just have a couple more notes. Two more notes I'd like to make.
Yeah, go for it.
Well, first off, the most of the movie was shot at midday to perfectly emphasize how hot it was.
That must have been very difficult for the actors to film in.
It must have been brutal. So all that sweat rolling off of them was really genuine. Because New Mexico in the summer at midday, I'm sure, is not fun at all.
Yeah, no.
One more point. I absolutely loved, loved, loved this soundtrack. Dude, I was so excited. It had Townes Van Zandt on it. It had Coulter Wall. These are all guys I listen to anyway. Chris Stapleton, which is huge in the country music right now. And it had Ray Wiley Hubbard, who's a great guy. I mean, a great musician. And then one of my absolute favorites, the king of outlaw country, Waylon Jennings. Dude, I got so excited when the Waylon Jennings song came on, You Ask Me To. And then it just pans straight into the conversation of the two brothers in the truck. And they're kind of having a dispute. And then they just start singing along to the song. Oh, I was in Western country music bliss.
That's awesome, man. It is a great soundtrack and it fits the movie well. And I'm glad you could geek out over it. I knew exactly 0% of all of those musicians.
Dude, Waylon Jennings, when you Ask Me To came on, I might have verbalized my excitement.
Wow.
Yeah. So one more thing I just want to point out before we get to scoring.
Yeah.
Was that in this film, Sheridan wanted to talk about look at the economic collapse of the recession back in 2008. And he wanted to focus on isolated small town regions and not in the big cities. And he said, quote, you know, people generally think of the crisis and all of these things affecting big cities. It started in San Diego and then it went to LA and Orange County and it spread everywhere to all of these regions. And it did. He continues, but people don't think about how it affected these rural areas, which in a lot of ways are more vulnerable to fluctuations in economies. This was a fascinating statement to me because I grew up in a small town, not dissimilar to some of the towns depicted in this film, although my small town is in the mountains of North Carolina, so the topography is definitely different. But when the recession hit in 2008, it absolutely wrecked the town. And I had no idea until I read that most people's perceptions was how it wrecked the big cities. But my small town was absolutely wiped out. And every time I go back there, it's died just a little more. And it's tragic, it's sad, but I could connect with this film because it showed all those little small towns that have not recovered and are dying from something that happened 12 years ago.
Yeah, it's an excellent portrayal of how poverty can change mm-hmm. you.
Yeah, it makes you desperate, and you can definitely understand why Chris Pine and Ben Foster are doing what they're doing, even if you don't agree with their methods.
Right. It's just a great movie.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm so thankful that you chose this movie. I loved it.
Yeah, man. I'm so surprised you hadn't seen it, and I'm glad I could introduce you to a Western that I actually really enjoy.
Yeah. Thank you.
I got you. So just to score it quickly, it's hard to find many flaws. So it's more of a gut feeling score mm-hmm. than anything. I'm going to give it a 9 out of 10. It's riveting. It's one of those movies that really captures your attention from a technical perspective. It's all excellent. The performances are all excellent. And it's just an affecting, powerful story that's hugely entertaining to watch.
I agree with everything you said, by the way. I'm going to give it a 9.5. I absolutely love this film. It was a film that when you watched it, it was a typical Western, Hollywood Western set in, the Wild West, except it was in modern times. I loved that. It felt like we discussed at the onset of this, a simple plot with deep personal stories. It was wonderful.
Absolutely. I completely agree. So if you take anything away from this episode, go watch Hell or High Water and skip The Great Silence.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I think we're ready to move on to second segment. Yeah.
Let's do it.
Sweet. So we are moving into If Best Scene Was an Oscar, Part 2, 2016.
I'm very excited for this.
What we'll do here, we will each list our nominations. We each have 5 nominations. We don't know what they are. They might overlap. We don't know. And we will quickly talk about the scene, just spend 1 or 2 minutes quickly why we like it. And we'll do that for each of our 5 nominations. And then at the end, we will each pick a winner for what would have been our personal scene, personal best scene for 2016. Note, this is a subjective list, subjective little activity that we do. So might be different from your pick. I know ours, well, I don't know if ours will be different, but we'll find out. So you want to
find out together, shall
yeah,
we?
Yeah, you want to start us off, or do you want me to start?
You know what, I'll start us off.
Sweet.
The first nomination for Best Oscar 2016. Best, yeah, the best scene.
The best Oscar of all time. Best of
all time. My number one choice, and this is not ranked.
Yes.
Is Rogue One. It's from Rogue One. Mm-hmm, the mm-hmm. Darth Vader corridor scene.
Yep.
Holy crap. Rogue One, not the best Star Wars film. I think we can both agree on that, though varying levels of best is yeah. up for debate.
I have it near the bottom of my Star Wars ranking. You have it kind of in the middle.
It's towards the bottom. I rank the 9 Skywalker films, saga films, ahead of Rogue One.
Fair.
But this scene, we've been waiting decades for pure Darth Vader carnage, Darth Vader unleashed, but because of the day in which the original trilogy was released, we never got that.
We got and stiff, awkward wrist movements with lightsabers. And Alec Guinness doing a spin move.
Alec Guinness, oh, the goat. Alec Guinness is always a win. At the end of the film, right towards the end of the film, we get this little nugget. They're trying to steal the Death Star plans, and they've nearly escaped. And there's a door that's jammed, and they're trying to get to the other ship, and Darth Vader just shows up, and you see in this tight corridor the red lightsaber ignite slowly.
Oh, yes.
And the whole corridor lights up in this crimson, evil red.
And you see some rebels panic.
Because can you imagine, put yourself in their headspace, you hear of this legend, almost this myth of this dark warrior with a lightsaber. This is 19 years since the end of the Revenge of the Sith. Some of these guys, I'm sure most of these guys, have never even seen a Jedi or a Sith, and you just see this almost this monster just, and you know you're screwed.
But my favorite one is when he force pushes a guy onto the ceiling and slices him in half as he's walking by.
As we like to say here on We Watch Movies, it's so good.
It's so good. The other thing I'd like to point out is I read this. I can't give credit. I don't remember, but I read a post somewhere that said the end of that scene when Darth Vader's looking out into space at the ship that's getting away, his cape is flapping like in a really epic fashion, and this post said there's no air in space, so there can't be any wind in space, which means Darth Vader is extra enough to use the force on his own cape.
Oh, that is hilarious.
Yeah. I'll just jump right into my number one. It's the Vader hallway scene in Rogue One.
Was there any doubt that this scene would not be on either of our lists.
It was this, always going to make it.
Regardless of the film it was in, this is one of the best scenes of any Star Wars film.
Yes, it might be the best scene. Who knows? It would be up there for sure.
This makes me want a full-length Darth Vader film so badly. So yeah. I can just get more of that.
Yeah. So why don't you move on to your number two, since we both had the same number one.
La La Land.
The whole thing?
The whole thing. No. Well, I would love to talk about the whole thing, if you don't mind. I've got time. Do you have time? No.
Surprise third movie.
It was hard. A surprise third movie. La La Land is about... It was hard for me to pick one scene from this movie because, as you know, I adore this movie way more than I thought I would. Mm-hmm. I can't get enough of it.
This one's also on my top 10, by the way.
It's been, what has it been, almost 2 months now, and I'm still humming the songs. I watched it once, and then I got the Blu-ray, and then I watched it twice in 3 days. I love this movie. But I decided the scene I was going to go with was one of my favorite musical numbers, A Lovely Night.
Ooh, yeah.
That's just great. Two leads, Mia and Sebastian, Emma Stone, Ryan Gosling, he's kind of walking her back to her car, and he's playfully flirting with her, and then they just break out into song, and they're in this great atmosphere in Los Angeles. The sun has set. There's a purple sky. It looks fake, but not so fake that... I'm sorry. It looks fictitious.
Fantastical.
Like a fantasy. It looks fantastical. It looks like a fantasy, but still holds on to just enough realism for you to question whether it's real or fantasy. And I just love it. There's the callback to Singing in the Rain, the dancing, the singing. It is, I know I sound super, super weird right now, but
it's awesome. Freaking adorable.
It is. And their banter back and forth in the song.
I love it. It's wool.
It's wool. So you'll call. It is. And the song.
Yeah.
It's great. Shout out to Damien Chazelle. Great movie. Great scene. What is it? Justin Horowitz, his college roommate who composed all the music for the movie. Awesome. Good job, Justin. This was a great, great original piece. And a great scene. The choreography, Mandy Moore, you get my seal of approval, which is a thumbs up. Awesome.
It is awesome. And hey, my number two scene was almost A Lovely Night. But instead, the La La Land scene I chose was the epilogue.
Ooh.
And it is the scene, where at the end Mia and her husband walk into Seb's and she sees Sebastian and their eyes meet, and he starts playing the theme, and we get this whirlwind fantasy that's like 7 minutes long of what their life would have been if they had stayed together. And it's beautiful and heartbreaking, and it is this gorgeous amalgamation of all of the previous songs with these crazy wacky visuals going on that are amazing and creative. And it's just a roller coaster of emotion, because that gut punch of her walking into Seb's hits so hard, and then getting what could have been also hits you really hard. And then her giving that one last look, and Sebastian just kind of nods at the end as she walks out, also hits really hard. It's just like three gut punches in a row, but it's such a beautiful scene with gorgeous music, gorgeous colors. It's very bittersweet, but you do at least go away with the taste of what it could have been, what it would have been if they'd stayed together. It's a perfect scene.
I think the two single greatest moments in Damien Chazelle's young directing career is the two moments in Whiplash and then the other in La La Land where J.K. Simmons gives his seal of approval, his thumbs up, if you will. I love it in that dream, the dream future sequence where he's, J.K. Simmons is standing there with his arms crossed and then just starts, you know, doing his jazz hands.
Oh, man. Grumpy J.K. Simmons and Damien Chazelle, name a more iconic duo.
Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone.
Ooh, I like that. Oh, so, yeah, that's my number two scene, epilogue of La La Land.
I almost picked that. It was probably the third on my list, my short list of La La Land scenes. I will say that my sister and my mom hated the ending.
Yeah.
They were like, it's so sad. And I can't want them to be together because he's married and he has a child. She's married and she has a child.
And he has his club and he's successful and happy.
Yeah.
It hurts.
Like you said in one of the Lost podcasts, though it hurts for us as the viewers, we can definitely tell that though it's a bittersweet moment, they're both happy and content in the lives they chose.
Yeah. Yeah. And if they hadn't met before, they wouldn't be happy now. Like, their meeting had a purpose, and it both bettered their lives, but they were supposed to go different directions.
Right, and because Sebastian pushed Mia to do something she would never have done on her own volition, and pushed her to keep going after she had given up, and then Mia really helped Sebastian get over his pig-headedness.
Yeah, and convinced him not to call it chicken on a stick.
Yes, which someone, I didn't come up with this myself, but someone on Reddit pointed out, and I don't remember who it was, that it's interesting that he was so upset about the samba tapas and how it was an insult to history, and yet he wanted to combine jazz and chicken.
Hey, chicken,
because
chicken transcends history, man.
It's true, but it was an interesting analysis that he was so blinded by his own dreams that he couldn't see the irony in it, which I appreciated. And Mia probably could see it, and she helped him out along the way. And this is not about La La Land, but we should probably move on.
Absolutely. So what's your number three pick?
I almost picked another La La Land, but I decided we should at least keep it to one movie. Nomination. Number three is X-Men Apocalypse, the Quicksilver Mansion Rescue.
Ooh.
I know you haven't seen the movie. Have you at least seen that sequence?
Yes, I've seen all the Quicksilver scenes, all two of them.
So this was a toss-up for me between Evan Peters' Quicksilver Mansion Rescue scene or the obligatory Hugh Jackman Wolverine cameo where he just wrecks carnage in the middle of the film. And you're like, whoa, Wolverine shows up and he just is, he goes berserk and it's awesome. But we're talking about, I just wanted to give a little nod to that. The X-Mansion scene, Quicksilver shows up. He realizes the mansion is exploding and he goes through this. It's probably like 3 minutes, a 3 minute montage of him quick running through the mansion and saving everyone while also having time to have some soda and eat some pizza and moonwalk. It was great. It was set to Sweet Dreams by the Eurythmics. Great song choice. It was a lot of fun. It definitely upscaled from the Jim Croce Time in a Bottle kitchen rescue sequence from Days of Future Past.
Yeah, man. So that's both Quicksilver scenes are hugely entertaining and awesome.
Evan Peters is gold as Quicksilver. He's awesome.
I can agree with that.
Speaking of, I just want to point out that Evan Peters has been cast in a unknown role for the WandaVision Disney Plus series.
That's exciting.
I don't know what it means. I'm not saying that he's going to play Quicksilver, but if she's going multidimensional kind of crazy stuff, maybe it's not so wild to suspect he might. Who knows?
I'm excited to see WandaVision. Though. That show looks nuts.
I am so excited. It's set to continue production, I believe, next month.
Excellent. That's what I like to hear.
So I cannot wait.
Yeah. My number three pick is definitely the goofiest pick I have, but it was too much of a blast to not include. And that scene is Sabotage in Star Trek Beyond.
Oh.
Have you seen Star Trek Beyond?
I have not. This is a very Chris Piney episode, by the way.
It is. Chris Pine should be in every movie, just like Jeff Bridges should be in every movie.
I'm not the biggest fan of Chris Pine, but I loved him in Hell and High Water.
Chris Pine's amazing. So let me set the stage for you real quick. Enterprise is flying back to this utopian space station called Yorktown, and Yorktown is about to be attacked by this massive alien ship swarm. And this is like thousands and thousands of ships type of swarm that all move like as one hive mind or whatever. And the Enterprise, it's not the Enterprise at that point, I don't think, they're on a different ship. But the crew realizes the only way to disrupt the swarm's communications is through a specific frequency. So they're able to tune they're able to broadcast a frequency to all of the ships that disrupts the communications and allows them to blow up. So to the thing they used to broadcast this frequency is the song Sabotage by the Beastie Boys.
I knew that's where you're going. I was like, wait a second, I know what this is.
And it is the most nuts thing I've ever seen, and it made me so happy to watch. And like, they send the frequency to Yorktown, and Yorktown's like, we have the frequency. And the guy's like, broadcast. And you just get this huge blast of the Beastie Boys exploding a bunch of alien ships. It's so funny. And then Spock looks at Bones and he's like, is that classical music? It's the greatest thing ever. I love that scene so much. And I encourage you to watch it on YouTube if you don't watch the whole movie.
I think it's interesting that I, as a Star Trek fan, have not seen Star Trek Beyond, and you have.
I've seen all three of the new ones. I like them a lot. I think they're fun.
But not enough to watch The Next Generation or Voyager.
You know, I've seen all the Next Generation movies.
Oh, not the new movies. Bullcrap, the show.
Oh, I've seen some of the show, but I've seen, I like Generations, I like Nemesis, I like Insurrection's not very good. First Contact isn't very good either. Meh. But yeah, that's my number three pick, Sabotage in Star Trek Beyond. It's too good.
It is a good pick, just from the way you described it. My number four, Magnificent Seven.
Oh, yeah.
Bar scene.
Bar scene. Cool. Yeah, set the scene for me. Set the scene.
Your standard Western bar, okay?
The saloon.
There at the table dealing studs happens to be a cowboy by the name of Chris Pratt.
One of the most well-known cowboys of all time.
Right up there with Jesse James and Billy the Kid. Chris Pratt. He's playing cards, and you get this great sequence of events where they accuse him of cheating or something like that, and he pulls up a gun. It's good. And then, as this is all unfolding, in walks Denzel Washington.
Denzel's in that movie?
Denzel's in that movie. In walks Denzel Washington. You're like, hey, I know that guy. It's Chris Pratt. And then in walks Denzel Washington. And he is collecting on a bounty, and he goes up to the bartender. And I don't want to spoil it because it's a great moment of acting by Denzel, but the bartender is the guy. And the whole place is about to go into a shootout because the bartender pulls a sawn-off shotgun on Denzel, and he kills him. And everyone reaches for their guns, and they all... Once Denzel turns his guns on him, on everyone in the bar, they just kind of set back down. And someone at Chris Pratt's table tries to pull a gun slowly out. And Chris Pratt points his gun at him and keeps him at bay. it's a great scene. I love it. I'll probably have you watch that too. I'll be interested.
I mean, I'd love to watch that movie. It sounds pretty fun.
You should watch Tombstone. You should watch Magnificent Seven. Why did I make you watch The Great Silence? I don't know.
Yeah, that's mess your around. Problem. You should watch The Revenant. Great Silence.
Leo. Leonardo DiCaprio.
Oh, he's so good in that movie.
So good. Yeah, anyway. It's a great scene. It's a lot of fun. The tension awesome. In the air. Chris Pratt and Denzel Washington's characters meeting for the first time. It's great.
Very nice. My number four pick is the Batman warehouse takedown in Batman versus Superman.
Ooh.
If you love Batman Begins, you love the Dark Knight trilogy, all that. They're great. Phenomenal. You have not seen Batman like this. Martha Kent has been captured by bad guys, and she is being held in a warehouse.
Who is?
Martha Kent.
Why did you say that name?
My bad.
I just need to get that out there.
Yeah, that's a good one. The Ultimate Edition makes that more believable, by the way. So watch the Ultimate Edition if you haven't.
I mean, I understood it watching the theatrical cut, but okay.
Martha Kent is being guarded by many goons in a warehouse. And you see Batman fly up in his Batplane. And then we cut to inside the warehouse. And lo and behold, Batman comes through the freaking floor and just starts taking dudes out. And it is brutal and awesome and looks like one of the Arkham games. And it is the best Batman action ever put to film. That scene is awesome.
Some people died. Someone died. Someone had to die.
Yeah, that's okay. There.
It was epic. I mean, come on. Let's face it. If he didn't kill some people there, but was fully willing to kill Superman, it kind of betrays all what Batman stands for.
Of that Batman, yeah.
Yeah. Batfleck was great.
That scene, I watch that scene sometimes just for fun. It is. Zack Snyder, just visuals for days that look so good. It was so brutal, so fun. He throws he bat grapples a crate into somebody's head and smashes them into the wall. It's good stuff.
We need to see more of that in four words. Zack Snyder. I'm sorry, that's not Justice League Snyder Cut.
He almost had it.
I almost had it, but Zack Snyder Justice League didn't work.
Yeah, I think they're pitching it, marketing it as Zack Snyder's Justice League.
I'm so excited for that. It's a bit off topic, but I'm so excited for that.
Me too. I need the Snyder Cut almost as much as I need Tenet, but not quite.
I need Tenet.
I need it.
I need Tenet to continue.
Like on the hierarchy of needs, it's down there with food, man.
Down there. Yep.
Yeah, it's the bottom is the biggest needs.
I gotcha.
I took middle school science.
I took it twice. So top. No.
Okay. What's your last number five final pick?
My fifth pick comes from Hell or High Water. And wow. It was a toss-up between the car scene where they were listening to You Ask Me To by Waylon Jennings. And the scene I ended up picking was the car shootout, or the truck shootout, rather, because they were all trucks. When, like we talked about, Ben Foster gets out of the truck with his, I think it's an AR-15 with a bump stock, but don't quote me on that. He gets out, he pulls out the gun, and he just goes to town on these 10 trucks, and all they've got are their hunting rifles and some pistols, and they're so outgunned, ridiculously outgunned, and all of them turn tail and just take off down back up the road. It is hilarious. Like I talked about, the double-ended clip, he fires yes. all the rounds in the one end, takes it up, flips it around, keeps going. Oh, it's great.
And the sunglasses just make it better.
I know. He's awesome.
Yeah, that seat is fantastic. I think that's mm-hmm. a great choice, man.
Thank you.
My last scene, I'm going to be honest, picking the scenes for this list was pretty easy for me. I had a good feeling of what I wanted on the list of nominees. Yeah. I still haven't decided what's going to win.
Yeah, neither have I. This is tough. So
this is going to be interesting. But my fifth and final nomination for Best Scene 2016 is the Sea Walk in Moana.
Okay.
Moana is a movie that I adore with every fiber of my being. It is hilarious and heartfelt with great music and gorgeous animation. And the climax of this movie is this lava creature, Tikal, is just coming for Moana, and she's trying to find out where to put the heart of Te Fiti. And she realizes that Tikal is Te Fiti, and she, using her water powers, like parts the sea, and there's this beautiful slow motion walk with this gorgeous arrangement in the background. And she walks, and you see Tikal lower its head, and she just, oh, it's so pretty. It's art. I love that. It's
so pretty.
It's so pretty. It's just a gorgeous, gorgeous scene. It took my breath away in the theaters, and it still gives me chills whenever I watch it. It's a beautiful climax to that movie, Moana kind of becoming who she was supposed to be, who the water wanted her to be. It's real good, man.
We all aim to be what the water wants us to be.
Yeah. Yeah.
What do you want me to be?
So, yeah. Why don't you give a quick rundown of your five nominees? Just list them off as a refresher. I'll do the same.
All right. Again, my five are: number one, Rogue One, Vader corridor scene. Number two, La La Land, A Lovely Night. Number three, X-Men Apocalypse, Quicksilver Mansion Rescue. Number four, Magnificent Seven, bar scene. Number five, Hell or High Water, truck shootout.
Okay, and I have number one, Rogue One, Vader hallway scene. Number two, La La Land, the epilogue. Number three, Star Trek Beyond with Sabotage. Number four, Batman versus Superman, the Batman warehouse takedown. And number five, Moana with the Sea Walk at the end. Do you want to go first, or do you want me to go first?
Why don't you go first?
Thanks, man.
No problem.
Okay, this is gonna literally happen. Like, I'm just gonna say what feels right in that moment. And the winner for Best Scene 2016 goes to La La Land.
Wow. Wait, are you sure? Are we sure this time? Did we double check? It is La La Land?
Okay. It is La La Land. La La Land takes the Oscar.
Wow. Shocker there.
The epilogue in La La Land, I think, is the best scene in 2016 by a hair.
It is beautiful. By a hair to what? What would you say was your second?
The Sea Walk.
Okay.
Yeah.
See, I definitely would vote La La Land on that.
Yeah, those two were kind of more emotional and serious scenes. The other three were kind of fun, entertaining scenes. But yeah, they were all super close. But I'm giving it to La La Land.
The winner of Best Scene 2016. The Oscar goes to La La Land, A Lovely Night.
Hey. I thought it would be that or Vader from you.
Man, I when you said La La Land, I was like, man, I can't pick La La Land now, but
if it's your pick, it's your pick, man.
It's my pick. I gave it a slight edge. Oh, someone's going to hate me for this. I gave it a slight edge to Hell or High Water's Truck Shootout. And only because I just saw that this week, I thought maybe I should give it to something I've seen more.
That's fair. That's a fair assessment. So, recency bias is real.
Yeah. And let's face it, I sing that song more than I should.
It's a great song.
It got to the point where Ryan Gosling was the 11th most listened to artist on my Spotify, which is terrifying.
That's hilarious.
Terrifyingly hilarious.
Well, I think that's going to do it for us this week.
I think that is. Are you surprised by our winners?
I don't think so. Yeah. I feel like when I first saw, was looking at the list of 2016 movies, my brain was like, well, duh, it's the Vader scene.
Yeah.
But I thought more about it. I think I'm happy with La La Land winning both. It's in my top 10. I'll never complain about that winning anything.
Yeah. When I chose La La Land, I'm sorry, when we chose 2016.
Yeah.
I knew that La La Land was probably going to win, and the only reason I had any hesitation was because then I went and watched Hell or High Water.
Yeah.
So.
But that'll wrap it up for us this week. Any closing thoughts before we end?
No, I think that's about it.
Sweet. Follow us on Instagram at We Watch Movies Podcast, no spaces, no caps. And next week, we will be taking a look at two musical movies, not musicals, but musical movies, two very different ones. So we'll be taking a look at Bird and Baby Driver.
Yeah.
And Forrest finally watches Baby Driver. I've been begging for this for years.
He forced me into it. He finally found... I'm pretty sure he suggested we start a podcast just so he could get me to watch this movie.
I'm confident it will be at least an 8 out of 10 for you.
We will see.
So those are our two movies. Our second segment will be a discussion about some of our favorite uses of different songs in movies. So expect some mentions of Guardians of the Galaxy. Yeah, it should be a fun episode. I get to watch Baby Driver again and watch a jazz musician play music.
Charlie Parker, directed by Clint Eastwood. Is there anything more me than that movie?
There actually, you know, thinking about it, no, there really isn't.
All right, wrap this thing up.
Yeah. Well, this has been We Watch Movies. He's Forrest. I'm Elijah. And I think at this point I'm supposed to say, stay beautiful.
You have been beautiful.
Should I try it again? I messed it up.
Yes.
Okay. He's been Forrest. I've been Elijah. You've been beautiful. This has been We Watch Movies. We will see you next week.
See ya.